Hey guys, Lady Luck here. Are you going on any road trips this summer? I know I'm going to be going on a bunch of road trips. And being that I'm going to be passenger princess, I love playing on SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest has all of my favorite slot games, live blackjack, live craps. Head on over to SpinQuest right now and get yourself a $30 coin pack for just $10.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
True Crimers, welcome to Break the Case. I'm your host. I'm Jen Coffendaffer. I'm very excited about this particular segment because we are joined by Julie Grant. Julie Grant, for years, had her show on Court TV and just brought us so many segments about true crime every single day. But a lot of people don't realize she is also an attorney, a barred attorney. She practiced as a prosecutor, and she just, there is so much more to her than being an anchor, although she was great at it. Let's admit that. But beyond that, just her legal knowledge and what she really did for a living before Court TV snatched her up as an anchor. So I want to bring her on today as a legal mind, our legal mind, to really delve into the Keefe D. Tupac, that particular crime, the case, what's going on in it. There is no one that knows more, I swear, on this planet than her, other than maybe the people involved in it. All right, without further ado, here we go. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Jen. Hi to all your wonderful viewers. Please forgive my voice. I woke up with laryngitis today, of all days. And it's definitely my fault. And I think I know why. I forgot to take my allergy pills for like 3 days in a row. And living in Atlanta, the trees, for anybody who's familiar down south, oh my goodness, the pollen is something else. So as I struggle to talk, I feel great. I'm so glad to be on here with you. And yes, I love this case. This case, I'm so glad you're doing this one. Thank you for bringing it on your show.
Well, what I love about this case is really people tried to sort of characterize it as an unsolved murder, when I think all of us, anyone who followed this, knew it could be easily solved if people would just cooperate. But in the gang culture, you don't cooperate. Can you give us, we're just going to go character by character, talk to us about our deceased victim and tell us just all about him.
Sure. So Tupac Shakur was a beloved rapper, perhaps one of the most prolific rappers of all time. I mean, truly of all time. When it comes to songwriting, his voice, the messages that he was able to convey, a lot of people in his short life. I mean, he was only 24. This is older than he was at the time of his murder. This case is 30 years old as we're getting ready and they're picking that jury right now, the case over his murder. And when I think back to him being such a baby at 25 years old, I remember it clearly. And I'm sure probably many of your wonderful viewers do too. I can remember being in high school and middle school, high school-ish. And there was the rap culture that involved these kind of rap wars, if you will, the East Coast, West Coast rivalries. And that was kind of part of the music, but there was a very real element to it as well, as you know. So Tupac was based in California, well-known, beloved West Coast rapper. And he was said to be kind of feuding with rappers on the East Coast. We think of Biggie Smalls being an East Coast rapper, probably the most famous one at the time. And Tupac was signed to a label called Death Row Records, owned by the infamous Suge Knight. And Jen, I know you know this, and I want your viewers to know this, because I think this is a really important point. Even though Suge Knight was a very successful businessman and an entrepreneur, producer, the owner of that big label that had a lot of famous artists, not just Tupac, make no mistake about it, this guy is a hardened gangster. A hardened gangster. I mean, he's doing a 28-year stretch right now for killing a man that he ran over with his truck. He's got a voluntary manslaughter charge. So that being said, he's the founder and executive of Death Row Records. He signs young Tupac and they become the best of friends. And throughout this blossoming of Death Row Records, they loosely affiliated with the Mob Piru Bloods. So Mob Piru, a subset of the infamous Bloods gang. And Jen, I know you're really an expert on gangs and gang culture. You've done tremendous work, and God bless you when you served as an FBI agent, you know, all of the great work you did on the ground, infiltrating them. It's remarkable. And Tupac became affiliated with Mob Piru, so didn't become a member, but developed this affiliation, perhaps to look tougher, to look harder, perhaps to enhance the reputation that Death Row was where the really tough rappers went. So the Bloods notoriously have feuded with the Crips. And Jen, you know this, and the man on trial who's going to be in the courtroom probably any minute now to start with jury selection on day number three. This guy, Dwayne Keefe D. Davis, was a very influential member of the South Compton Crips. And so he became a ranked member of the Crips. And throughout his, I guess, work with the gang, he became very well known in drug dealing and became a really, really heavy player in the drug culture. And with that role, he earned a lot of money, albeit illegally, but he had a lot of money and he amassed quite a fortune, as I am told. When that happened, he became even more influential and more powerful within the Crips. And in Compton, you know, which we know is a really rough area of California, you know, he became quite the guy and was living quite the life. So what happened with the incident in question occurred in Las Vegas, not in California. So there were lots of people there to see a big Mike Tyson fight in September of 1996 at the MGM. Tupac was there, Shug was there, Keefe D was there, members of the Crips, members of the Bloods, lots of people were there converging on Vegas. There was an incident earlier in the day before the fight at a local mall where Keefe D's nephew, Orlando Anderson, had his Death Row Records chain stolen from him in a robbery. That was apparently done by someone named Trayvon Lane. Trayvon Lane was part of Tupac's group, part of Mob Piru, part of that the clan, you know, that was rocking with Tupac and Shug and those guys. So Trayvon Lane is said to have stolen Orlando Anderson's chain. Well, in the MGM, you might remember there's that video of Tupac and Shug beating. I'm mixing up my facts, Jen. Wait a second. Let me back up. I'm getting my names wrong. It was Orlando Anderson who took Trayvon Lane's chain. I'm so sorry. It's early in the morning and I apologize. I was up half the night coughing. Okay. So Trayvon Lane had the Death Row Records chain on. He's the one associated with Tupac and Shug. So Trayvon Lane is this victim of this robbery, right? Earlier in the day at the mall. And Orlando Anderson apparently was the one who snatched it. Orlando Anderson being a member of the Crips, KVD's nephew, okay? So when they're at the MGM, apparently Trayvon Lane says to Tupac and Shug, hey, yo, you know, look over there. that guy, and he points to Orlando Anderson, that guy is who stole my death row chain. So Trayvon Lane gives us information to Tupac and Suge about Orlando Anderson, Keefe D's nephew. And Tupac and Suge just take it upon themselves to deliver that beatdown. And the video, it's all over the place. I'm sure you've seen it. I'm sure your viewers have seen it. They are stomping on Orlando Anderson like he didn't stand a chance. So he gets stomped on. Security footage in the lobby gets all of this on tape. So that is what precipitated Tupac's shooting. So Orlando is Keefe D's nephew. Keefe D is super influential at the time, had lots of money from being this really heavy hitting dealer. He and Orlando and two other guys get in a car. And according to police, they go looking for Tupac. And Tupac was in a car with Suge Knight. Suge was driving. Tupac was in the front seat. A couple other guys in the back. So what happens is they're on the strip and they're at a red light. And Suge is driving. Tupac's in the front passenger seat. And the car with Keefe D in it and Orlando Anderson pulls up right next to him. And someone in the back seat sticks their arm out of the window and fires multiple gunshots, hitting Tupac Shakur. He dies a couple of days later in the hospital. Keefe D is said by police to have been the shot caller, to have been the one that gave the younger gangsters, like his nephew, the other guys who were in the car who were much younger than him, coming up in the Crips, gave the order, if you will, to execute this shooting. Orlando Anderson, his nephew, is who is believed to have been the one that carried out the shooting because of his relationship with Keefe D. Keefe D is his uncle, and he's the one that got stomped on by Tupac just a couple hours before. However, Jen, this is going to be something to watch for in the trial because, as you know, there was another guy in the car who was seated closer to Tupac's car. So Orlando would have had to reach over him out of the window. And there's some people that don't think that may have happened that way, that it might have just been, hey, give the gun to the guy closest. But either way, Vegas police allege that it was Keefe D who got that gun illegally in Vegas and passed that gun to the back seat in order for Tupac to be shot. So that is what precipitated the shooting. It was a retaliatory shooting, according to police. Gang violence, rival gangs doing stupid stuff, a stupid chain robbery earlier in the day. And then it results in this beloved rapper losing his life.
You know, Julie, you go through it so well, and I know why you're talking. It's like a retaliation on a retaliation. And how many times, so in the gang culture, just to give a little bit of background, in the gang culture, any sort of disrespect, any sort of, you can even look at a rival gang member's girlfriend. You can walk by their car and just touch it. You can be in their territory. That can initiate somebody being ordered to be killed. So you can imagine a necklace that says death row, which is basically like a cross to these people, being torn off their neck. And then the retaliation for that, which is the beat down, which then the retaliation for that is you have to kill the people who did the beat down. And quite frankly, I don't even know if without the beat down, just the snatching of the death row record might have been enough to order a hit. And I mean that most sincerely. But this was a big guy. Julie's talked about how, Tupac was back in those days. And I know many people just sort of know him legendarily, except for those in our chat that are over a certain age that would remember growing up and understanding how really famous he was and hearing about all of these different rappers being so big, and, you know, Death Row Records, which went on to hire and incorporate the music of so many and just make millions. And but because of gang rivalry, because of this whole disrespect mantra, it can cause you to be killed in a minute. And that's exactly what was ordered and what happened here. So thanks for going through sort of that history. I was curious, because I do not know this answer, with Tupac, how much street life did he really have? Or was it all about trying to gain street cred with, you know, the gang left, tats, you know, him purporting, really putting himself out there as a banger? Was he really a banger, or did he just want to have the reputation of being a banger?
That's such a great question, Jen, and I've wondered that myself. So I think the most knowledgeable person on this, for any of your viewers who want a deep dive, and I've asked him about this, his name is Greg Kading, LAPD detective, retired now, but worked this case intensely. He's the one who interviewed Keefe D and got the information about how the shooting allegedly went down. And I did ask him about that, because I wondered the night of this incident if Tupac knew what he was getting into when he did that beatdown, because of the question you just raised, which is brilliant. You know, he's wanting to portray this hard gangster image as a rapper. And in life, it's true, he was affiliating with this subset of the Bloods, the Mob Piru Bloods. He never became a member. He never went through initiation. He never did the things that one needs to do to become a gang member. But he was closely tied on the outside. And I wonder, to this day, I really wonder if he truly understood what he was getting into by going after Keefe D's nephew. You know, because a guy like Keefe D, you know, his image was living the high life. I mean, this guy was driving fancy cars and taking fancy trips. And I mean, he's a money guy. I mean, look at him in the suit. I believe that's him right in the center there. You know, having a champagne, and you know, he was a money guy. You know, he worked his way up, and with the drugs, just was seen as living a lavish lifestyle. And I wonder if Tupac realized and had the foresight to think, okay, the ramifications for this, as you explained, Jen, in gang culture, any sign of disrespect, like you said, could be a death sentence. I mean, and it was for him, this beatdown, it was, you know. And I wondered, you know, there was part of me that was like, I wondered about Trayvon Lane, and I asked Greg Kading, I was like, do you think he had improper motives, like saying to Tupac, hey, that's, you know, like, go fight my battle, essentially. And Greg's opinion is, you know, from studying these guys for years, is that no, that it was more like a heads up. There's a guy over there who's not with us. He's not one of us. And matter of fact, he came at me at the mall earlier today and we had a problem, just so you know, that's who's over there. So he saw it as more of like a warning. But I wonder if Tupac would still be alive today if he didn't go down that road of the gang affiliation, because, you know, he was far too talented to be getting into fights and all this, and then getting shot in the streets.
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting, because a lot of gangbangers, their life is totally consumed with that. I mean, from the minute they get up to the minute they go to bed, it's about drug dealing, it's about extortions, it's about committing horrific crimes, robberies, trafficking kids. I mean, their whole life, the gang culture, is all about violence. And that's what they do all day. It's like people who get up and they go to the beauty salon to work, or they get up and they go be a teacher all day. This is their life. Drugs, it's all their life. And then hear you look at this association, but I would argue that he well understood those complexities. So gang associates are interesting because having gone after many gang associates, meaning still went after them criminally when they did something wrong. You get onto them because of their association with the gang, and then you find out, well, they're still working on the side with their gigs that are really gang associated, but they just, as you said, haven't gone through the initiation process. So just getting his chance with Death Row Records, I think it was very important to Shook Knight that he knew he had the loyalty, that he knew that he had a gang associate. And so, and I think the reason why he never thought what he did would get him killed was his notoriety and the, you know, just shock of it all that somebody this famous would be killed. And I think he just totally underestimated what gang culture would do to him for doing. I mean, that's really catastrophic to beat up one of the head guys in a gang, a Compton guy's nephew. Big mistake.
Right. You're so right, Jen. You're so right. You know, and I love that point you made about the fame, and you wonder, reaching such a level of fame at such a young age, if there was maybe a false sense of security, maybe feeling a little bit untouchable. And they were also on the Las Vegas Strip. For, I'm sure your viewers, you know, have been there at some point, you know, everybody watching. I mean, I think we know how busy it is, and sometimes we think there's safety in numbers, and when we're in a busy place, something like this can't happen. And yet this was so bold, so brazen, so horrible. And as I look at Keefe D and this photo of him now, I think about how Keefe D and Shook Knight, Jen, a lot of people don't know this, but these two knew each other from childhood. They grew up together. They played sports together. And when these cars were side by side, and Shug is driving and Keefe D is in the passenger seat of the car that shoots, absolutely, these two saw each other without question. And it's really a travesty that Shook Knight never said anything to police to try to help solve this case for his best friend and artist who made him an awful lot of money. But it goes back to the first point I made. You know why, Jen. He's a hardened gangster. He's not going to snitch. He's not a rat. He's not going to do it. And he knew Keefe D from way back when. And just goes to show you, even with the different affiliations, you know, Keefe D obviously was a ranked, you know, member of the Crips. And Shug is, you know, an affiliate and associate of the mob Pyro Bloods, still even being members of rival gangs. He wasn't gonna say who shot Tupac.
Yeah, the biggest, I think, misnomer in a lot of cases is that people think, oh my gosh, there's 10 witnesses right there. Nobody hides their face typically, or seldom, because they need the street cred. They want to show how tough they are, that screw everyone here, you know, forget about law enforcement. I am going full-faced and I'm going to commit a cold-blooded murder, right? They're still all cowards because they always ambush and bring a gun and ambush the person. But nevertheless, they go full-face. And why? A big part of that is they know that in this culture, the 10 witnesses are never going to say who it is, because it's a part of the fact that they hold that back. And they don't want law enforcement to be involved because they want to exact their revenge. So the last thing they need is law enforcement's sticky hands in the middle of their gang war and their gang business. They want to be able to go back and say, you did this, you're going to get this, and it just continues. And how reminiscent, like when we saw on the Strip, right? You can just picture, for those of you who have been in Las Vegas, these, how you're stopped, on the strip, right? You can never go anywhere. You're there. All right. What am I going to do? While you wait for the, you know, the lights to change because there's so many lights. It reminded me so much, of course, and it really is, the same thing that happened with mobsters back in the day. They killed at will for territory, for being disrespected. And it's exactly analogous to the Crip and Blood gang culture still exists today, is no different than the Italian mob culture.
Amen. Amen. You're exactly right. It's the same kind of thing. It really is. You know, it's money, power, influence, violence. I mean, it's just, yeah. It's scary stuff. You know, it's scary stuff. And I think that's something that is troubling, because sometimes we see in entertainment, the mob life is glamorized. You know, in the rap culture, you know, the gang world is a bit glamorized. And, you know, we see that. We see rappers trying to kind of blend reality, in, you know, with artistry. And here, I think if Tupac had leaned a bit more into the artistry and maybe had some better people around him protecting him, maybe we wouldn't be here today with his trial. Maybe he would be alive. And it's hard to say, but it's oh so sad. I mean, this case, it breaks my heart, and I'm so happy to see something finally done about his murder. You know, as somebody who grew up on his music and loved listening to, still love listening to him, I'm so pleased that this trial is moving forward finally, Jen.
Let's talk about that. So it's been 30 years. Let's talk about the big break that put Keefe D in jail pending trial. Let's talk about his big mouth and big piece of paper.
You got it. So what's important to know is that all of the people who would have been potential witnesses to this, besides Suge and Keefe D, are all dead. So everybody who was riding in those cars that night, all of those occupants are deceased, except for Suge, as we know, who's in a California prison, and Keefe D, who's in a local jail, getting ready for his trial next week. Keefe D said nothing about this. No one talked about it. His nephew, Orlando Anderson died in another gang-related shooting incident not long after Tupac was killed. And some years down the road, this LAPD detective that I mentioned, Greg Kading, who wrote an excellent book called Murder Rap for anyone who really wants to get into the intricacies about the investigation. He talks about the murder of Tupac Shakur and the murder of Biggie Smalls and what he learned throughout his role. He was investigating a big drug case in LA where Keefe D was the main target, the big fish. And they got him. They caught Keefe D, and they leaned on him a little bit and said, hey, you know, if you want to give us some information about what happened to Tupac Shakur so we can pass that to Vegas police, because this has gone on far too long. We know, you know, we would be willing to give you a plea agreement and shave some time off your sentence, because you're going to do time for the weight of the drugs. I guess it was a massive quantity and it was a big get. So they made him this promise that, Jen, it was not a formal immunity agreement that involved prosecutors. It was not what's sometimes referred to as a non-prosecution agreement that's signed and approved by a district attorney. This was less formal, but it was an understanding between the LAPD detectives, Keefe D, that this was an exchange of information. In return, you get a lighter sentence if you plead to this. So he told them that he was the one who ordered the hit, that he was the shot caller because of what happened to his nephew, Orlando Anderson. And so this is memorialized by Detective Greg Kading and his partner and others, you know, who worked on this, passed to Vegas police, and perhaps provided maybe a little bit of peace, a teeny bit of peace, maybe, to Tupac's family to know definitively what was behind it, the why, how it went down. It was much simpler than people thought. I think a lot of people, myself included, because I was just ignorant, you know, growing up, we heard about this and people thought it was some crazy conspiracy and who killed Tupac. It was some big mystery. But really, you know, special agents like yourself, Jen, know that this was gang culture. And a terrible example of what happens when you're living the gang life and a retaliatory shooting for something so stupid. So Keefe D gives this information up, goes, does his prison sentence, gets out of prison, proceeds to live his life in Vegas. He's 63 years old now. And it was a few years ago that he decided to write a book about himself, calling himself Compton Street Legend. And he writes this book, and in the book, he brags about how he was the shot caller who killed Tupac Shakur. And he brags that he was responsible for the biggest case in Las Vegas history. This beloved 25-year-old prolific rapper who was far ahead of his time was killed because he called the shot. And so these smart detectives like Greg Kading and others took a look at the book that Mr. Legend in his own mind wrote and they conferred with Vegas police, you know, and Vegas police got a search warrant. They hit his house, searched the home, and then they filed charges not long after for the murder of Tupac Shakur. And legally, Jen, for any of your viewers who might be wondering, even though Keefe D didn't pull the trigger, we know that, he can still be held responsible for the murder by way of ordering it. If he ordered it, he says he didn't. You know, he's going to trial and he's cloaked in the presumption of innocence. So we'll see what happens. But if he did order it, even without touching the gun in terms of the firing, he can still be criminally liable.
Tell me, Julie, what problems do you see? I want you to put on a different hat right now. Let's put on the prosecution hat. What problems do you see that you would have with your case right now?
Sure. So one of the problems is that all these witnesses are dead. This is a tough one because everybody's dead and Suge Knight is useless to them. I've thought about this. If I were a prosecutor, I've thought, what would I do? Would I subpoena him and have him transported and, you know, let him be useless in front of the jury? Maybe, but it's a futile exercise, you know, I think, because he's not going to add any information. He's not going to paint the picture. As a prosecutor, you're going to be relying largely on Keefe D's own statements. And he does a lot of talking. And so there's going to be a lot of, hey, this is what you said, you know, before. This is what you said in your book. Is he going to have to take the stand now? I mean, if I'm a prosecutor, I'm going to prepare for that because he's a 63-year-old cancer patient now. And he may come off very sympathetic to a jury because of how he looks, because of his illness that he's been battling. He's not the influential, you know, gangster that he was once upon a time. The other thing that it's not a fatal thing for the prosecution's case, but I expect the defense to exploit it, is it's really hard to be sure who fired the fatal shots. Might have been Orlando Anderson, who was right behind Keefe D, or it might have been the guy next to him who was closer to the car. If Keefe D ordered the shot in general, you know, one of you do it, if prosecutors can prove that, then that's enough. They're good. But to get there, that's a steep hill, you know, because Suge's not going to say anything. Keefe D isn't going to snitch on himself. He's not going to say, you know, yeah, I admit this. I mean, we know he's fighting it. He's going to likely, I expect him, you know, to say something along the lines of, you know, one of them did it on their own. I lied about being the shot caller. I did it because I'm a clout chaser. I was just trying to look hard. I was trying to look like I'm tough and like I had influence. But, you know, my nephew and the other guy, they just did it on their own. The gun was reachable in the back seat. I didn't touch it, didn't provide it, didn't. I expect a lot of denials. So when you're looking at beyond a reasonable doubt, this is not an open and shut case. I mean, it's not. I think it's decent for the state of Nevada. I expect them to win this case. But if Keefe D has a good attorney, he might just say, you know what, get up there, get on the stand. Typically, attorneys will discourage that because usually, you know, Jen, you don't help yourself when you get on the stand. But I think in a situation like this where he is in his 60s, it sounds like he's really on borrowed time with his cancer diagnosis. He may want to just roll the dice and see if he can walk. If they walk him, he may be able to do that by testifying. So I would be a little bit, you know, nervous if I am one of the prosecutors that he's going to retract all that, come up with a different story, probably along the lines of what I just shared with you, Jen.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here. And you know what's more American than America's 250th birthday? Supporting American-owned companies like SpinQuest, America's number one social casino with over 1,000 games like Live Dealer Blackjack and Craps. They're offering new users a $30 coin package for just $10. Go to SpinQuest.com and sign up today.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Well, and what's interesting to me about this is I totally agree with you that this is a long road to hoe, as we say in the farming business. It just is. It's difficult because, as you said, everybody's deceased. We don't have a murder weapon, to my understanding. And really what they've gone on are his own words. And one thing that I wanted to make clear about particularly people that rise up in gang life, they are not perhaps what you were thinking in terms of intelligence. They are typically very intelligent, very manipulative. They've risen for a reason. They're very good at controlling people. They're very good at getting their way. They are ruthless, meaning lie, cheat, steal, kill for their position of power. But they are anything, at least in my experience, the ones that I interviewed, it's amazing how smart they are and how charming in a lot of instances they are. I remember being in these interview rooms at the jail after we had these pleas where people were looking at life and they ended up serving maybe 15, 16, 17 years instead of the rest of their lives because of our plea negotiations, but still a lot of time. And just thinking, man, if I just would have had this person as a child to raise, if they weren't raised by a dope fiend mom who was putting cigarettes out on them, kicking them out into the snow, treating them horrible at the age of 5, where they're just on their own. And that's how gang members usually come together. Literally, their moms, grandparents, whoever it might be, have literally kicked them to the curb, and they form together to have a safe place where they can just walk down the street without being beat up and abused. And that's literally, especially in a place like Compton, how you see, I call it monsters made. They didn't start off monsters. They were made into monsters. And I mean, when your mom is treating you like that, how do you have empathy for anybody? You don't. But my point is, he's not a dummy. This is a smart cat. And I think he will take the stand based on a lot of the reasons you said. You know, he could talk about his cancer. He could talk about, listen, I didn't even write this book. This was written by a ghostwriter. I don't have an education. I couldn't have written this. And I think he's going to fall back to those words are puffery and of me trying to just get more cred and money, right? How much money was made off of that book? Probably a lot.
That's right. That's right, Jen. If he wants to win this case, excuse me, I'm sorry. If he wants to win this case, he's got to paint himself as a clout chaser. That was all about just cred, clout, me trying to, you know, appear influential in my old age. You know, I've maybe lost a little speed on my fastball, you know. I mean, he's probably been out of the game for a while. And, you know, maybe this was his way of, you know, a little puffery and write this book, he's calling himself a legend, for crying out loud, you know. And when I asked Greg Kading about that, you know, like how, because I was really curious, like how bad of a guy is Keefe D? Like how dangerous? And he was saying, you know, all his power was from the drug culture. That it was that because he became such a notorious dealer and amassed such a large amount of money, that he really was a powerful guy. And so, you know, to your point, he didn't get there by being stupid. So, yeah, he might be prepping right now with his lawyers. We're talking, you know, to do a direct examination and say, you know, because, you know, Jen, I mean, these guys, they aren't afraid of taking felonies. They're really not afraid of being in the system. He's been in the system, you know. But I think at this point, this is about his freedom. And I think he's maybe looking at life a little bit differently with a diagnosis. And he apparently is living kind of a more quiet life in Las Vegas. You know, he's not living the life he once did.
Yeah, and you find that as people age out. I mean, so few make it out of the gang life. They either end up forever locked up. They end up dead of either an OD or not the leaders are typically not even the ones that are real hooked. You know, they're not doing crack every night. Like, they have to run their organization. And so it's really surprising how together they keep themselves, but typically they end up dead. I mean, that's just most of the time. They're dead or locked up forever. So he's actually a legend in that way. Because he probably is one
legend
of the
legend that he didn't die. He's alive. He's a legend. So funny.
But yeah. Talk to us about, so this is Suge, and we discussed, I mean, the grandfather, creator of Death Row Records. I mean, yeah. I don't know if I want to say billions. Let's say millions. It's probably billions. I haven't looked, though, at what it was worth at its peak. But so you say, as a prosecutor, you're not going to put him on the stand because you know you're just going to get a big zero. I'm telling you. I'm not an attorney, but as your law enforcement officer on the case, your detective, I might be pushing you to, because Suge Knight might want more money on his commissary. He might want to be transferred to a better place. He might want more visitation leniency. And even though he's a big fat liar gangster, he may tell the truth about this.
Yeah, you know, he might. And I've often wondered, you know, might Keefe D and his lawyer want to bring him in? And the reason I say this is because if we kind of play the tape through, he's not going to rat on his childhood friend. He's not. And if they bring him in, the only other living witness, what he's probably going to say is, I didn't see nothing.
Yep.
I didn't see nothing. And so then the jury's like, huh, well, we don't have a witness who saw anything, you know, like, how can we? So I would not rule out that possibility. I mean, I think desperate people do desperate things. I think Keefe D, as you noted, Jenny, you know, he's an intelligent guy and he just might do that. And Suge, you know, he's an interesting character. He's done a couple interviews and some podcasting from prison. And so it's funny, you know, to your point, it seems like he's got something to say, but, you know, he's very choosy when he does. And You know, he doesn't want to be a rat. You know, and I know from, you know, speaking, you know, to people who know of his reputation, in the prison system. I mean, he is feared, feared. He is every bit a hardened, dangerous gangster, and he's known as somebody you don't mess with, and also somebody who's not a rat, doesn't snitch. So he has a lot of people's respect in the prison system for that as well.
Yeah, I will say this too. People like him who become institutionalized, I mean, even though Shawshank is fiction, there is a lot to learn from that show because definitely they did a lot of great research on that movie. I talk about that movie only to say that's someplace you can actually look and see how there's a different hierarchy. And I promise you, in prison, people like Suge Knight, they can still keep up the drug trade. They get prison guards who are making 20 grand or 30 grand a year on the take. They get things brought into the prison. They have cell phones. They can do a lot and manipulate a lot. They make, you know, drink in their toilets that they sell that are basically, you know, they use fruit and thing that they steal and ferment and make. But I'm telling you, the drug trade and everything goes on all the time in these prison systems. And if you're a guy like Suge Knight and you have kept up your gangster, not only persona, but living the life in there is no way he's going to snitch on either side. He's not going to show any all of a sudden loyalty toward Tupac, in my opinion.
You're exactly right, Jen. You're exactly right. He won't. And, you know, and it's a shame. And I think for all of us, you know, whose hearts break, that this wonderful artist was killed. His family had to suffer and is still suffering and in agony over what happened to him. It feels so cruel that his best friend, who made a lot of money off of him, wouldn't do the right thing when it came down to it. Because if he had, I mean, if Suge would have just done the right thing, this could have been put to bed that night. Police could have interrogated all of those people in those cars who are now dead and figured out, okay, who saw what, who was the shooter. You know, perhaps they could have recovered the murder weapon. That's another great point you made, Jen. They don't have it. It could have been recovered at that point. You know, maybe there could have been better processing done. Well, actually, I don't. To my knowledge, the shooting car was never processed. So, you know, additional processing is what I mean to say on that car, to try to figure out, you know, who fired. I mean, this could have been put to bed so long ago. And yeah, I really it breaks my heart. Something else I want to alert your viewers to that I just thought of when you asked me to kind of put on the defense hat and think about what may be coming for the prosecutors. I want to tell all your wonderful viewers to watch for Sean Diddy Combs's name to be brought up by Keefe D's defense team. So at the time when Keefe D was very influential with the Crips, Diddy would go to him for security, and Keefe D would provide protection with his men when Diddy was in California for various, you know, events and such. And Diddy started out, I think we all know, you know, started out as a producer, and his artist, you know, he had Bad Boy Records. His artist was Biggie. That was his biggest artist, the artist who really made him take off. And publicly, Diddy and Suge made it seem like Biggie and Tupac were warring. But really, in my opinion, Biggie and Tupac were just victimized by other people, you know, around them and by other circumstances. That being said, Keefe D would provide security for Diddy. So they were close back in the day when Diddy would travel to California. And according to statements that Keefe D made, two detectives. Greg Kading is one of them, who memorialized all of this through his work. KVD said that at one point in time, Diddy said to him, "I would give $1 million for those guys' heads," meaning Tupac's head and Suge Knight's head. That's how much he hated them, because they were so much business competition for him and the money that Biggie was making. So he's said to have made that comment to Keefe D. And after the shooting occurred, there is information that Diddy called Keefe D and said, "Was that us? Like, was that us who did the shooting?" Greg Kading did some investigating as to money and where the money was paid. And apparently some money went through an intermediary, never even reached Keefe D. But there is some evidence, it's my understanding, again, through what has been documented by these detectives who worked the case, that there might have been a true intention to stand behind that statement. And so if Keefe D, as a trial strategy, decides, well, I don't want to go with a clout chaser theory, he could go with a someone else ordered the hit theory and try to point the finger at Diddy, who, you know, the bad boy, that was his, you know, his image that he was portraying. And now he looks like a bad boy because he's sitting in a New York prison right now for what he did. So I've seen in some of the pretrial motions, Jen, that I've read, the defense is talking about him and talking about this connection, the statements that Diddy made. And I expect them to perhaps bring that before the jury. So that could be another big factor, and also something that's going to make this trial even more explosive than it already is.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, Diddy, who now is going to be in prison even longer because he messed up on the inside and got in a fight. I mean, Diddy is a billionaire bad boy. That is just a fact. And when I say bad boy, I don't say it like, oh, bad boy. I mean, he is powerful and was powerful. And I could see him doing almost the third party culprit. Listen, yeah, we talked about it. I didn't pay. I didn't order it. That was all Diddy and his money. I could see him bringing both in. The book is Puffery and the real hitman is Diddy. Wouldn't that be something?
Oh, that would be something. You know what? And Suge hates Diddy so much. You're like, that might prompt Suge to say stuff. Like, this could get real messy real quick, Jen, as you know. I mean, I think this is going to be quite a trial. I am just like, wow. It's really something. And again, that book, if anybody wants to read it, I highly recommend it. It's a really fast read. And it has a lot of information about Keefe D's statements and contact with Diddy and all of that. It's called Murder Rap by Greg Kading, who, by the way, is probably on the witness list. I know I would call him if I was a prosecutor. I'd probably make him my number one witness. The guy is so good. Really, really, really good investigator. And, you know, his heart was breaking for Tupac's mom and family, you know, all along the way, you know, and Biggie's mom and family, you know, it's tragic. It's so horrible.
Well, and I know there are people out there, let's just face it. I mean, I see it in comments and so forth. Yeah, well, you have a gang guy taking down a gang guy, taking down a gang guy, right? When you look at everybody, as you mentioned, these young people are all deceased, and it's because of their gang affiliation. And so I think a lot of people end up having little feeling of compassion. But at the end of the day, for our justice system to work, we have to have justice for everyone across the board. And so no matter what people might think about the gang stuff, if you can't control and get, you know, and that's why, for those of you asking, why in the world, after 30 years, did they really decide to pursue this? And to me, law enforcement and prosecutors are trying to make a statement that everyone deserves to have their life protected. And if you're going to murder somebody and we know who did it, we're going after you.
You're exactly right. You're exactly right. It, no matter what the amount of time is that's passed, there's always time to prosecute someone for a murder. And that's what this was. This is a murder, a cold-blooded murder. And so good on those prosecutors for stepping up. This isn't going to be an easy task to do. So they deserve a lot of credit.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Julie, I have absolutely worn your voice out. You were such an
angel. No, I came on sounded terrible. I'm sorry to all your viewers. I'm so sorry. Next time I join you, Jen, I'll be back to normal. Let's hope.
Oh, gosh. Well, we just love having you. I love that lawyer.
I love your show.
I think you would be a great assistant to prosecute this case because this is something.
Oh, thank you. I wish I could.
Yeah.
I wish I could. I wish they needed a special prosecutor to come in. I'd be like, put me in, coach. I'm ready. I want to see the family get justice. They deserve it. But thank you so much for talking about this on your show. You're amazing, Jen.
Yes. Thank you, Julie. And I hope to see you very soon. Bye. Thank you. Do this. Uh-oh. Sorry, Julie. Let me grab the wrong button. Here we go. Listen, I just wanted to come and say thank you, everybody in chat and for all the moderators. We are so lucky to have Julie on the show. She's got a lot of really cool things she's working on in the background, which I'll let her announce those. It's going to be really exciting for her, I think, as she fades into a new career and blossoms into some of the items that she's looking at. But in the meantime, it was so kind of her to share her time, even with having laryngitis, to discuss this case, a case I mentioned as a reporter. I don't know another reporter who has really been intensely on this case for so long. So we're happy and always thrilled when we have Julie come on the show. So coming up tomorrow, as you may know, we have Dave Ehrenberg coming on to talk about the Clinton case and that despicable plea agreement. That's what I'm going to call it. But we'll hear what Dave Ehrenberg has to say and why he thinks that Clinton got the deal she got. We also have on Saturday at 10 a.m., as promised, we have a expert coming in, former law enforcement, 10 plus years doing statement analysis. He's going to be on. I'm excited to have him. I'm actually hoping to have a panel working with about three or four others to maybe have a panel discussion about things like whether it's AI, whether they believe it to be real, what they think. Because as you know, this is the other side of the pancake show. We always try to show both sides of the case and let you all decide on what you think. And then also this afternoon, I'm actually working on and hoping to get a do another show on Nancy. There's some items I really want to talk about on the Nancy Guthrie case that we've followed so closely. And so I'm working on that guest and working on another slant, if you will, that I wanted to talk about. All right, everyone. Y'all have been great. I know that Tupac, Keefe D, this might not be in your palette of crimes that you're looking more closely at. I know our channel is so much about missing people and Nancy Guthrie and Clancy type cases. But I think it's really important that we keep our eye on the ball, especially with jury selection happening today, with wanting justice for all. So until next time, may justice be served.